Welcome to Sharkpedia. We're your hosts, Megan
and Imani,
a couple of shark researchers that want to bring the science to you.
We're creating a space to learn all things sharks
and their relatives,
answer your questions,
and learn from the legends in the field.
Get ready to jump in.
Let's dive deep into the world of sharks.
Hello, sharkies. We're back for another episode.
Hello! Welcome back!
We are so excited to have Dr. Britt Fanucci this week, and we are super excited to talk about her article. Dr. Fanucci, would you like to introduce yourself first for our sharkies and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi, everyone. My name is Britt Fanucci. I'm a fishery scientist at NIWA in Wellington, New Zealand. I'm originally from Canada. I moved to New Zealand about 11 years ago to do my master's in marine conservation. Ended up sticking around, did a PhD where I looked at our bycatch, shark bycatch in deep water fisheries. And yeah, I've just been hanging around here since. I work on a whole number of research topics these days, but my favorite is still working on the deep water species and understanding their biology and ecology and ways that we can improve reducing our interactions.
Cool. We're super excited to have you on.
Yeah, definitely. We haven't had anybody on the podcast yet about deep water species, so we're super excited to jump into that. So thank you so much. Today, we're going to break down Dr. Fanucci's paper, Aggregations and Associations in Deep Sea Chondrichthyans. So our summary for you all today is as follows. Group living has been recorded across a diverse range of chondrichthyans, but given the nature of deep sea chondrichthyans, any inferences on social associations have yet to be described. Using a companion preference analysis, aggregating behavior and associations in deep sea chondrichthyans, including 4 helicephalans and 10 elasmobranchs, these were evaluated across class and group size from long-term archived fisheries independent research trawl survey data sets. Results indicated that not all selected species engaged in aggregative behavior, but those that did suggested patterns of sex and size-specific associations, which varied with catch density. Adult females were caught most frequently in low densities and were highly associated with other adult females. And adult males were consistently associated with each other. The nature of association provides important insight for selective mortality, such as targeted fisheries. So one of our first questions, just to kind of introduce this topic, is can you describe for our listeners that are just hearing this in the summary, what are helicephalons and where do they fit within the chondrichthyan group?
Yeah, of course. So holocephalans, which some people might know better as chimeras or ghost sharks, they are shark relatives. So chondrichthyans as a whole includes 3 groups. You've got sharks, which are your true, you know, everyone kind of assumes stereotypical bitey great white sharks. And then you've got rays or your flat sharks. And then you've got ghost sharks, which comprise of, I think we're at about 51, 52 species now. So it's a small group. It's very understudied, but it's also a very exciting group, very ancient group of fish, and we're finding new species and plenty of new information about them all quite frequently.
Awesome. Yeah, we haven't had any ghost sharks on the podcast yet.
We obviously need to get more. That's a hole in the podcast.
There's a very select group of people in this world. It's also very hard to get your hands on them. A lot of them are found in the deep ocean, and they're quite cryptic in nature. So just being able to find them in the first place is quite a task in itself. So a lot of our ghost sharks are only known from, like, you know, a handful of specimens.
I had my first encounter with a ratfish this summer, and they're really cool. I don't know what I thought a chimera would look like. Like, you see pictures of them, but then we pulled them up and I was like, this is actually a really cute animal. Also, their spines are crazy.
Yeah, their spines are crazy. I've stabbed myself a couple times with them. But yeah, I find like pictures just don't capture how stunning they are color-wise.
They're so cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they're fantastic. Was that a Hydrilagus coli?
Yes. Oh, yeah, yeah. We have that really beautiful like coppery lines.
They've always got an iridescent kind of pattern to them.
Yeah. Yeah, they were super cool to look at. I was kind of obsessed with them for about a week after we caught them because I was just not expecting it at all. And then my brain was like, I love you.
Is there an advantage to having that iridescence that they have? Do you know?
I have no idea. A lot of ghost sharks, they also have deciduous skin. So unfortunately, when they're brought up, which is often by trawling gear, their skin actually falls off. So a lot of times they can actually look a lot more ragged than they would look when they're kind of pristine in their underwater environment. I'm sure there's some thing that it's used for some visualization of some sort, some adaptation, but nobody's looked at that to my knowledge.
Cool. This is actually a really good segue. What is a trawl? I don't think we've actually explained trawling in any of our podcast episodes.
Oh yeah. So trawl is it's a type of fishing gear. It's basically a net that you throw over the back of a boat. They can be used for inshore fisheries. They can be used for offshore fisheries. You can fish quite deep, 1,000 meters plus. And basically they just, depends where they are too. So you've got midwater trawls, you've got bottom trawls, you've got bottom trawls that sit off the bottom. So that kind of just depends where in the water column they're actually fishing. And they get hauled by the boat that they're being towed along, and they will basically scoop up anything in their path and then that's brought up. And yeah, probably a very poor description of what a trawl actually is.
No,
it's giant net you throw overboard and you
tow it
and you tow it and you catch pretty much anything in its path, which also makes it one of the more destructive means of fishing, because it isn't very selective, and you don't really get a choice of what you catch in the net.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of regulations around trawling as well for that reason, but it can be a great way to get a really good representation of what is on the bottom. So you used a historical data from the New Zealand for Primary Industries trawl database. Is there something special about that trawl database? Is it research specific? Do artisanal fishers contribute to that data set at all?
No, so that there are, our trawl database, it's completely fisheries independent, which is what you want to truly monitor fish and, bycatch species as well, because when you've got fishery dependent data, that data can be largely influenced by the fishers and the fishing industry themselves, because they're out there to catch the fish. So you've got to factor in things like fishing behavior if you want to use it for kind of monitoring purposes, whereas our fisheries independent data, we go out there and everything's random, everything's designed in a way that it is supposed to be representative of what's out in the environment, regardless of whether or not we are looking for it, essentially.
That makes total sense on why you wouldn't want to use fisheries data for this type of research. And you did note also that you selected to use surveys that were consistent with vessel design, vessel size, capability, fishing gear, operating procedures, and that also took place specifically between austral spring and early summer, which in New Zealand is October to January. Can you describe what a stratified random survey design is that you specifically wanted from the data sets?
Yep. So for me personally, I had nothing to do with the stratified random design. That is how our surveys are designed themselves. And basically, previous generation of fishery scientists had designed statistical methods to basically sample the environment. And basically, a stratified random design is taking a grid and throwing it on an area that you want to sample. So that's your stratified area. You've, you know, divided that area up. And then using technology, toes are randomly sampled from within that grid. So it is just, it's just a means of, again, providing a completely random sample. It's using statistical tools that, you know, you can compare with previous years. As you mentioned, we're always using the same gear. We're going at the same time of year. And that's what you want. So you can actually look for patterns over time. You can take out, you know, you want everything to be the same. So at the end of the day, you can say, well, you know, if we're seeing changes in fish stocks, that's because of changes in the actual fish stock. And it's not attributed to a change in the gear that's being used or a change in the time of year.
And is it hard, like with all the parameters that you had, was it hard to select data out of that? Did you have to like remove a bunch of data sets because they didn't meet all the criteria that you had?
We always do a little bit of grooming. You know, we've got people that go out on the boats to do the surveys. There's always the occasional errors. Humans make errors. That's just what it is.
Surprise.
Yeah. So the errors that generally come across, you get the occasional species identification issue, which isn't much of an issue now because we have great identification guides. We have a much better idea what our fish diversity is, but that is still growing. And other things like measurements, which sometimes comes down to the actual technology we're using on board. If you're on a vessel and, you know, sometimes we have 5-6 meter swells and the boat's jumping up and down, so then the scales don't really work well and you try and measure something, but also you're being thrown across the boat. So it became quite difficult to actually measure what you want to. So more checks on the measurements of the animals themselves, just to make sure they're kind of biologically accurate.
Yeah, and speaking of the lengths, you noted in your materials and methods that you measured the chimeras different from other chondrichthyans. And that was like news to me. And I wondered if you could explain to me and our listeners, why would you have to measure the total length differently for chimeras?
Right. So chimeras, you've got the main body of a chimera and the fins. And then what extends from the end of the tail essentially is what's the caudal filament. It's incredibly long when they're first born, but it does tend to reduce in size as they get bigger. Presumably it gets eaten by something at some point in their lives. So it's not a reliable measurement to actually use. Chimeras, depending on where you are in the world, there's different kind of standard measurements that are used, which is also a giant pain in the butt, because then you've got to, you want to compare across different areas or different countries, you have to make sure people have used the same measurement. So New Zealand, we use what's called chimera length. There's other measurements as well. Some people use body length, some people use snout to vent length. There's also, make sure I get this right, pre-supracaudal fin length. I might have missed something in there. So there's a whole whack of them, which makes it quite difficult to actually combine them all. But
that's a lot.
Mirrors are complicated. People like to make them more complicated than they need to be.
Yay. Yay, science.
Everyone has to reinvent the wheel.
So in your trawls, species density was estimated as the total number of individuals in the catch divided by the total distance or kilometers towed. Do you think that these trawls were fairly representative of the population of deep sea chondrichthyans?
It's a hard one to answer, and we'll probably never truly have the answer. It's the best available information we have. These surveys are not designed for sharks. They're not designed for any bycatch. Actually, they are designed specifically to make sure that our very important commercial fish stocks are in a healthy state. But because, you know, we also encounter a lot of other species, we take any biological measurements we can from these other species we come across. So in an ideal world, we would love to have, surveys that go out specifically designed for sharks themselves, which could be, you know, at different depths, it could be at different times of years. We just don't know. But unfortunately, these animals have very little economic value. So there's just not the interest to actually do shark-specific surveys. But like I said, it's the best available information that we have.
Yeah. So I was also wondering, so if you do, like you dump this net in and you do a trawl and you drag it for a certain amount, do you think that if you drag it for too long, you start, instead of getting like social aggregations, you're just getting animals that might be 10 feet apart for no reason? Like, what is the maximum distance something has to be for it to be considered a social aggregation as opposed to just like hanging out in the area that the trawl happened to go?
That's the $1 million okay. question. And that's why we kind of did this to kind of figure out if there is a statistical means of showing that, yeah, you know, there, you know, it is actually seems to be some evidence that these sharks were hanging out in the same area for a reason. But yeah, you're right. You could tow for days and eventually you pick up a lot of things. The tows themselves, they are also put down for the same amount of time, regardless where they are as well. So there's some standardization there. But yeah, you're right. You know, we might pick up one at the beginning of a tow, one at the end of the tow, and that might just be it. And they might have been, half a kilometer away and have had no interaction. But then again, you do get these big catches of hundreds of individuals, and you know, surely these animals were, you know, they were in a specific spot all together at the same time. And we do see evidence sometimes of breeding. The poor females a lot of times come up and they've got tons of bite marks on them. Males are just an absolute jerk to them. We make a lot of inferences about what we see in the trawls, and that's what we've generally had as knowledge for these deep water species.
Is chimera mating like also terrible like shark mating? Is it the same?
I've been told, I've never seen it. I'm told it has been observed in some of the animals that have been kept in aquariums. But yeah, similar sort of thing. So if you might have noticed on the males of ghost sharks, they've got these little knobs that stick out of their heads. So they've got one on the top of their head. They've got a pair of them above their pelvic fins. So these are called tenacula. And as adult males, they become calcified, so they're very hard, and they're also full of spikes. Apparently they use those to latch onto the females who have their very soft skin, so it really wouldn't take much. Their claspers too are not only massive, but they're also full of spikes and rough.
Oh my gosh.
Rough materials.
Why does shark mating have to be so brutal?
It's not, they can't be that pleasant to be a mature female shark in this world. Or a chimera. But yeah, most of the ones that I've seen, they're all full of scars and the like.
Oh my goodness. And then the way that you measured for social association analysis is that you only did densities that were over 20 fish per kilometer, because like you said, it would have to be at a certain density to imagine that there is some association that's possible. However, you included Eptmopterus lucifer, which is the lucifer ghost shark, in analysis regardless of the density. Could you explain a little bit more why you decided to include them? And also, can we just like talk about how cool the lucifer shark is?
Yes, lucifers are stunning little sharks. They're a lanternfish. So in the Imoptera family, you've got your lantern sharks, which are basically your glow-in-the-dark sharks. We do know that they are capable of bioluminescence. And we're not 100% sure why these sharks can glow in the dark, but it has been proposed that they are using it for communication purposes, particularly because the patterns of the photophores, what they use to essentially glow in the dark, they do change across species. So it does give some suggestion that it is, species-specific communication involved there. And lucifers themselves, because they are such small sharks, well, small fish in general, can be quite difficult to study when it comes with troll surveys because they tend to just actually fit through the trolls themselves.
I did not know that we thought that their bioluminescence might be for some kind of communicating. That's very interesting.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah, I've seen the actual glow in person, not on lucifers, but on a different species, and it's absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. And yeah, I've seen video as well. There's been some people in Europe that have been able to keep some camp in captivity, and it's just kind of this blank screen, and every so often you get those flashes of light, like what you'd see with other, bioluminescent animals. So yeah, there are some people out there who are studying bioluminescence in shark and trying to understand the processes. And I think once they understand, exactly how they're producing their bioluminescence, which apparently is hormone driven from what I've read, which is also very unique when it comes to bioluminescent animals. Yeah, that'll give us more insight of why they're using it.
What? Wait, so do other fish that aren't elasmobranchs, do they also use hormones to for their bioluminescence, do you know? Or is that like shark chondrichthyan specific?
No, I think for sharks it was a first because you got a lot of fish that use symbiotic bacteria, or what's the other way? It's bacteria driven, or there's another means, which I cannot remember, but I'm pretty sure, yeah, the sharks are the first ones that it seems to be actually hormone driven.
Doesn't so if it's for communication, doesn't that like somewhat imply that they're consciously deciding to do it? Or could it be passive communication? Is that a thing?
I would assume it's active, because you're in complete darkness down there. You don't want to be that one thing that's flashing off lights all
Right.
the time. Just makes you look like a target. Look at me, come take a bite out of me, kind of thing.
That'd be really cool if we discovered that they were like consciously deciding to communicate with each other, because to my knowledge, that's not something that we generally associate with chondrichthyans.
I know.
No, not at all. But there is evidence that sharks are communicating with each other. They're just communicating in a way that we don't understand yet.
Oh my gosh. This is,
Weirdos.
I love this so much. We need more shark interpreters, everyone. That's awesome.
So, in terms of statistical methods, which we've kind of talked about a little bit in some other episodes, but for yours specifically, you use some from Underwood 1981 to describe companions for each class of animal, where class is defined by sex and maturity. Are these methods only possible to use for trawl data, or can you use it in other fishing applications?
Well, the method itself was not designed for this at all. It was initially designed to study eland type of gazelle, essentially. And yeah, I came across this very old study, and we were trying to figure out a way where, how can you actually kind of look at social associations when all you have are dead things to measure? So yeah, I've taken that application and tried to apply it to something completely different. I'm sure you could. Maybe not things. There would be certain fisheries applications you couldn't apply it for, but if you had information on species, on sex, on size. That's, you know, that's the kind of information you need to feed into it. But basically, the understanding with that method is that when you it was designed to be able to identify social interactions when you can't specifically identify individuals themselves, which is, I guess, what happens a lot of time in, you know, big herds of grassland animals where there's just thousands of them all together, and keeping an eye on one at a time is just difficult, if not impossible. I don't know much about those terrestrial things.
Yeah.
Me either.
We don't talk about the terrestrial things here.
Only ocean things in this house.
It's too many things in the ocean to try and figure out, let alone the terrestrial ones. But yeah, that's the method itself was not signed for this at all. So by all means, things.
Yeah, I was really interested in hearing about this method because I think I might want to try to use it in some of the applications I'm researching. So yeah, it was just really cool to see that in general. That is basically sums up the methods of how you looked into this study and the data that you used. In your results section, let's get into that. It's super cool, all the things that you found. I don't know what I expected, but it wasn't what you found. I was really blown away by all the associations that you found. But first, of the chimeroids, only Hydrologus novozelandia resulted in a density of over 20 fish per kilometer and therefore was the only chimeroid included in social association analysis. And then the four species of squaloids occurred in densities high enough were C. crepidator, D. calcia, E. granulosus, and S. acanthius. Everyone, if you know the anxiety I have about reading out loud and just trying to read those names, please, please applaud. That was terrifying.
I'm clapping for you. I am clapping for you.
It sounded like a multiple choice question there.
So those are the four species. If you want to know the species, please look up Dr. Finucci's paper. You can see it there. And as well as our small friend E. lucifer, the lucifer shark, also occurred to have high densities enough to look at the association analysis. Were you surprised by any of the associations that you found, that there was that many significant associations, or were you kind of expecting there to be those associations already?
We did kind of expect the results themselves. We have looked at couch composition before, and you can kind of make some inferences. You know, there are toes where you might only get big adult animals, or there might be toes where you only get small animals, or you might get toes that are, you know, mostly male or mostly female. So you can kind of infer that, you know, there's something going on there. But it was nice to kind of apply something and be like, yeah, you know, this is actually what we're getting. I think the one I like most is that the adult females, they tended to only hang around adult females. I guess the one result that did surprise us was that adult males tended to hang out with juvenile females. There's a lot of debate about, you know, assessing maturity of these animals and whether maturity is purely biologically based or whether that is behaviorally based as well. You know, and most of what we've kind of used to assess maturity to date tends to be biologically. So, you know, are these animals actually built to reproduce? But there's more and more evidence that we see that there is a behavioral aspect to it. So we get a lot of adult males hanging around immature females that are roughly the same size. And when you take a look closer, you do find that these, what we thought were immature females, have actually mated. We've found, you know, a lot of these animals are able to store sperm. And you do find the presence of sperm storage in what we assumed were immature animals. I think that was probably the most interesting finding we had.
Awesome. So you started to briefly talk over some of those associations. So I'm just going to summarize the associations that you found for our listeners. Of the ones that had associations, that you found that had significant associations, there were a few trends that you saw throughout each species. First, that at low density, individuals in all classes were associated with other individuals in the same class for all of the species that you looked at. You also found that the proportion of adult females in the catch was greatest at low densities. Third, you found that adult females tended to be more often associated with other adult females across all densities. And lastly, the proportion of the catch that included juvenile males increased with increasing density. What do you make of these trends? I know you just touched on, you know, the immature males and what immature males are even doing with potentially some adult females, but what do you think is going on with those other associations that you found?
Adult males with immature females.
Oh, yes. Thank you. Adult males with immature females. Thank you.
Well, kind of these interactions kind of show kind of what we've already kind of suspected. You know, smaller fish tend to avoid larger fish because they don't want to be eaten. You've got males and females that tend to segregate, which we've kind of, you know, that could be attributed to energy requirements. Females get bigger than males. They require a lot more energy to be able to reproduce. So they might have to go somewhere where the males don't have to go in order to find, you know, the energy, the food essentially that they need. You know, we also speculate that females tend to avoid males because males are annoying. Males just want to mate all the time. And as we've discussed earlier, shark sex sucks for females. And the last thing they want to do is be constantly harassed by individuals that just want to bite on and mate with them. Yeah.
Yeah. I can't emphasize enough how hard that must be for the female sharks. And I often, when I'm having a day where I feel like I'm dealing with a lot of things, I'm like, you know what? I'm just incorporating my inner shark because I have thicker skin than my male counterparts.
Yeah. Just tell yourself that when you need to feel better.
I do. Every day.
So male groupings were frequently observed in other taxa, often attributed to foraging. But you write that it's difficult to conclude as cooperative behavior in sharks. Can you elaborate on this? What would we need to more strongly indicate that there is or is not cooperative hunting in sharks in the deep?
We need visual observations, which are probably next to near impossible. To find, we'd have to be able to actually watch these animals in their natural environment and watch them coordinate with some sort of prey item, similar to, you know, what you see with orcas, you know, and attacking larger whales. You'd need to be able to actually see it in person. And unfortunately, deep water research is incredibly expensive, and some kind of mentioned before, a lot of these animals are very cryptic to find in the first place. The deep ocean is the largest ecosystem on the planet, so it's like finding a needle in a haystack for some of these species. And yeah, being able to have the equipment to be able to monitor the deep water environment is incredibly difficult. So we get snapshots, essentially, what these trawls are, snapshots in what's going on at that particular time.
Yeah. I don't know. This might be a dumb question. Could you put like a GoPro on a trawl?
We do. Yeah. Yeah. It's not a dumb question at all. There's, don't know if they've used GoPros. I know there's different technologies that have been used as well. And I know we've made, you can design camera houses that can withstand pressure to, I think ours have been rated to nearly 2000 meters. And those can be attached to trawls. They can be attached to longline gear. And that has given us some great information on how fish interact around fishing gear, which can be used for mitigation purposes. You know, we do know that when a tow comes, some fish naturally go up and some fish naturally go down. So being able to understand So that information about the behavior of the fish can, you know, it helps. I mean, fishers have used that information for years to help catch fish better. But it also could give us some insight into how to not catch the things we don't want to catch.
Yeah, I guess I feel better about that question because it was not a dumb question. But in my head, I was like, would this even work? I'm just going to ask anyway.
No. There is no dumb questions. I've seen, yeah, I mean, I've also seen, I know they've used it here to look at sea lions, because we've had problems with sea lions getting captured in trawl fishing gear. So they put cameras on to watch again to see how the sea lions interact in the net itself. And that has helped design sleds, so sea lion exclusion devices, get the sea lions out of the nets. And I've been told once too that they actually saw a white shark came into one of the nets while there was a sea lion in it, and the sea lion freaked out, left the net, as did the white shark. So, you know, you could also
say
that white sharks would be good ones to have spooned around the nets to reduce the sea lion bycatch. But
interesting.
There's all sorts of applications to put videos on fishing gear.
Cool. It seems like the seal researchers should recruit some great white sharks to help them out.
Yeah, I mean, you can train dolphins to get data for you, so maybe you can train the sea lions to monitor the nets for you. Or not monitor the nets, chase away. I don't know. I don't know what I'm saying. But back to the data. You also found that you found a lot of juvenile groupings in a lot of this data. But you can't necessarily conclude that those were nursery grounds. And I wondered if you could expand on, you know, why you can't necessarily conclude that those were nursery grounds just because you found groupings of juveniles there. And what other data might you want to have to establish that it is a nursery ground?
Yeah. So, yeah, in order to confirm nursery areas, we need to know that they're used year after year, which is quite difficult to do when we're only looking again at like that snapshot in time. If we wanted to confirm these areas, one of the things that we are using to try and tease out potential nursery areas is looking at our deep water video footage. Again, this is not specifically designed for sharks, but we do have surveys that go out. They drop cameras down and mainly are looking at assessing the benthic environments, looking at benthic impacts of fishing and other human activities. And what we have noticed is that they do pick up quite a few observations of deep water shark, ray, chimera, egg cases in particular, little individuals as well. You know, so we can kind of combine all our data and, you know, try and tease out trends there. We have picked up an egg laying area for one of our deep water skates. The seafloor was just absolutely covered in skate eggs. And they look like they were laid at different times, which again could give us some inference that this is a nursery area because they're using it over and over again, it seems. We basically with deep water research, you kind of pull in anything and everything you can to better understand the animals, because we just don't have the opportunities that you do get with more shallow water species.
Yeah, no kidding. Ghost sharks are good at ghosting you.
So your classes tended to be more often associated with con specifics than expected from overall catch composition. Now, before I even go to the question that we have written for you, what is a con-specific?
Con-specific, in that term, was of the same species. So,
okay.
Yeah, the sharks tended to like hanging out with their own kind.
With their own.
Yeah.
Okay. And why do you think this is, or why did you expect there to be less association?
Could be a variety of factors. Again, certain shark species might have certain needs, energy needs. We do know that different species fill different ecological niches. So certain species will eat one thing and another species will eat something else. And so those prey items might be found in different areas. So that might cause them to kind of separate and hang out in their own areas. We also get these animals the species that we looked at too, they come in a very wide range of sizes. Everything from the little lucifers, which, you know, big ones get up to about 40 centimeters. And then you get, we call it seal shark. Overseas it might be called kite fin shark. And those can get up to 2 meters. And we do know that seal sharks like to eat little lantern sharks. So again, these animals are going to be separating because little ones don't want to be eaten by the big ones.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I think one of our last questions about a lot of your results in the discussion that you concluded is that in some species, you had densities that were over 100 fish per kilometer. And, you know, I don't really have a great visualization of what that looks like, but I just wondered, I mean, when it's that dense, is there even an opportunity for them to not be interacting with each other in some way? Because it just seems like they would be so dense and having to work around each other and potentially interacting in some way.
Yeah, I mean, the sharks could be introverted and they just want nothing to do to each other and they try to avoid each other as much as possible. But you do see it very often in deep sea that, especially around seamounts and areas, these are very highly productive areas. There's plenty of food. There's plenty of fish. So they do tend to, you know, squeeze themselves in these certain areas. So, whether they want to try and avoid each other, I have no idea. They in that kind of density, they'd certainly at the very least be aware of other presence around them.
Yeah, so cool. Well, is there anything that we missed from your article that we should go over?
I don't think so. It's actually funny that you picked that one because I haven't thought about this in years now. So I had to like go back to the article and stuff. I'm like, oh, what the hell did I do that many years ago? I forget what I did yesterday now. So it was good. It was good to go back and have a look.
Yeah, it seemed like a good opportunity to I was like, oh, this is a good article where we can actually talk about deep sea fish and chondrichthyans in deep sea. And yeah, I just got really excited seeing it. So
yeah, it's good choice. And most of what I've done lately is actually more shallow water things. I've even been working on turtles lately for some reason. nice to talk about deep water fish again.
Yeah, good.
Well, we'd like to conclude our podcast, as we always do, with our favorite field story from you. So this can be any field story. It can be a lab story if there's been some like cool discovery that's happened in a lab. But we would just love to hear about an experience that you maybe don't really get to talk about that much to share with our Sharkies.
Do we want a deep water experience?
Yeah.
Keep with the deep water theme. Yeah. So these surveys, they do go out regularly and I do get the opportunity to go out on some of them. I get incredibly seasick, so I have to be very selective about which ones I go on. And honestly, I could not think of one example in particular. But I did have one survey 2 years ago that I was out, which I was able to see quite a collection of deep water fish and deep water sharks that I just had never seen before, including a frilled shark, which was probably it was awesome. I was feeling so sick that day and went down to the lab to start my shift, and this frilled shark came up and I just like snapped out of everything and got super excited, grabbed the fish, was running around like, holy shit, there's a frilled shark there. And it was just absolutely amazing to actually see the animal there in front of
me. That's so cool.
Yeah. So yeah, I think the surveys in general, it's kind of like Christmas. You don't know what you're going to get. And then these trolls come up and, it's an opportunity to see a lot of things you just wouldn't see otherwise. Sometimes, hopefully, you know, when they're still in a lively state, I'll take a quick measurement of them and I'll pick them up and chuck them back overboard, which is also fantastic to actually see deep water species still alive. I think just being able to go out on the vessel itself is awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking, like, you're probably one of the very few people that have seen a frilled shark in person.
That's fresh one. Really, yeah, cool. So, we do. We do. It's a very lucky thing to be able to do and to go out there and see these fish. And yeah, I do. When I get back, I mean, I take lots of photos and I try and share them when I can, because I think it is cool. And I think if people are able to see what's actually out there, then they get excited about the deep sea, and then they want to get into deep sea research and start to see the value in it and see the value in conserving it and managing it properly. So, you know, we do have it for our future. So.
Yeah. Awesome.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for coming on. We were really excited to have you. For everyone who's listening, we have been trying for months to do this episode and it just hasn't been working out. So we're really excited that we were finally able to do it. Where can our Sharkies follow your work?
Twitter, Britt Finucci. I'm not as active as I used to be, but I am on there. I do have Instagram as well. Again, I don't put a whole lot out there, but those are the places to find me. I'm pretty easy to stalk. I'm pretty sure I'm the only Britt Finucci in the world, so if anyone really wants to find me, it's not that hard.
Awesome. We'll make sure to put your handles in our show notes so that our Sharkies can find you, so that when you do post, they can see your updates. Well, thank you so much again for being here, Dr. Finucci, and thank you, Sharkies, for being here with us. And until next time,
swim you later.